Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. And today we are joined by Martin Holm, the VP and head of M&A Integration Asia and LF Strategic Partnership at AP Moller Maersk. Martin is an inspiring agile leader known for his visionary approach to strategy, innovation, and technology adoption. With a remarkable ability to connect the dots and lead organizations to outstanding results, Martin embodies authentic leadership and a collaborative spirit. His global experience spans 6 countries across 3 continents, excelling in diverse roles within logistics, supply chain, e-commerce, and more. Martin's expertise is further enriched by his extensive board experience and educational background from prestigious institutions like Kellogg Hong Kong University of Science and Technology and INSEAD. I've asked Martin to join us here today to share his story and insights on driving change and achieving excellence in the dynamic world of logistics and supply chain management. So Martin, thank you so much for joining us, my friend. How are you doing?
Thanks a lot for having me, Daryl. Doing great this morning and looking forward to the session.
Yeah, and I'm excited to hear some of your insights. And I always like to start off by asking, how did you even get into this? Is this a family business type thing? Were your parents in supply chain and logistics and e-commerce?
No, it's not. I have to say it happened a bit by chance at the beginning. I thought I should be a construction engineer. And then, I come from Denmark and I had to do national service. And since then, I've had lots of great opportunities to develop and I've stuck around.
I love that. Was it all just sunshine and rainbows? You had some initial success and it's been nothing but sunshine and rainbows the whole way through, like just no pearly gates?
Of course, the world doesn't work like that. I think part of the reason I've become actually very fascinated and very passionate about supply chain and logistics is the part of the purpose, right? One of the things I really like to do is to facilitate global trade, because when we trade with each other, there's almost in every little trade or big trade, there's value generated. This is not a zero-sum game. This is where we're trading with each other and actually both parties are gaining something.
Yes, I love this, 100%.
And to be able to facilitate that for me has created a great purpose for my career.
I love that. So what are some of the biggest challenges that you faced? Obviously, 6 countries, 3 continents, there's cultural differences. You're in Singapore, you're from Denmark. Singapore is culturally more similar to China than it would be to Denmark. So what are some of the biggest challenges that you've had to face in your career?
Yeah, the biggest challenge I've had in my career was being responsible for recovering from a cyber attack. So that was definitely challenging. I was the chief operating officer of a $3 billion business at the time. And we lost all IT systems and eventually only got the first IT system back after 17 days. And we managed to keep the business running. So that was quite a challenge.
I'll put some fear into you. That'll give you some nightmares. But let me re-say this. So you were CEO of a $3 billion company. And under your watch, cyber attack comes in. All the systems are down. And I mean, at this point, what do you do? What would you recommend to someone that happens to?
Yeah, it's all about relying on the organization. And I'm still amazed at how my colleagues at the time really stepped up and collaborated and pulled through. Because the only way to survive, if you will, in this situation is really to delegate out to the front line and harness every brain and every colleague to find creative solutions to keep the business running. And my colleagues managed to do that. Yes, I was leading the effort to get us back. Truth of the matter is that this was a real team effort. Great, great experience actually to see what an organization can really pull off in a time of crisis.
Yeah, if I'm looking down, it's because I'm a writer downer. I'm not like on my phone or something. I'm taking notes. But that's, so step one, delegate to the front line. If this happens, the people that are in it, because I guess they have to figure out workaround solutions in the short term, while it's almost, if your power goes out in your house, perhaps it's different. Power goes out in your house, what's mission critical? Maybe the things in the fridge, in the freezer. Is it the middle of winter? Do we need to keep things warm? Maybe we need to make, so you start patching up the critical path solutions right away while you have a team dedicated to fixing the problem, it sounds like. Is that, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing we had to decide was, do we continue to take bookings from our customers? And within 12 hours, and still honestly on very sketchy information about what this really was and how long it would take and everything, we had to decide, are we turning customers away or do we continue to take their bookings? And we decided to continue to take their bookings, but that was a pretty difficult decision to take. And then from there on, of course, it's about, you know, executing on the business, still making sure that we transport the goods that we've been asked to transport, that we're able to release it, that we're able to give at least some visibility of where that cargo is in the world, and so on and so forth.
Wow. And so what were some of the other big challenges? That's great insight to that. I'm glad you brought that up, and I'm glad we gave people at least the basic, it's no holy grail, but at least something to think about in the interim if something ever happened like that to them. What were some of the other biggest challenges that you faced in your career?
Yeah, I think, of course, much more recently, we have seen some incidents really driving, if you will, havoc in global supply chains.
Now, yes.
It started with the trade war between China and US back in 2018. And then, of course, the pandemic 2020 until 2022, probably. And when you're helping customers around the world running their supply chains and delivering their products, this has been the biggest challenge for the industry as a whole over the last, since the Second World War, I would venture.
And I've heard that, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but I've heard that the supply chain indicators are showing a massive slowdown in global trade right now. Is that?
No, that's actually not so accurate, Daryl. I know that volumes are significantly down right now, and you can say that's a big reduction in global, what it's showing in my opinion. What really happened was that during the pandemic, supply chains, there were many more disruptions, and it took much longer time to get the product to where they needed to be in the world. And therefore, almost every company built in kind of buffers, buffer inventory. They had produced more. They had more in inventory. They had more underway. Ships were waiting, et cetera, et cetera. And what really happened is that now the disruptions in the supply chain have gone away. And right. That means that all that extra product that was somewhere in the supply chain, it all got delivered. And all of a sudden, almost every company actually had too much inventory because there was not so much inventory tied up in the supply chain anymore. And so they simply just stopped ordering for a little while they were working their way through the inventory. But if you look at consumer demand, yes, it's down a little bit compared to when it was at its peak. But it's not a significant reduction. And actually, if you look at trade balances between countries, you can also see that global trade is still continuing. Of course, there have been shifts to global trade. So where really it for a period was almost a one size fits all, and let's just produce everything in China. Right. Of course, now supply chains have started to diversify in the name of resilience and also to become more sustainable. And that has changed the makeup of the supply chains. But actually, global trade is well alive and kicking.
Yeah, I love that. That was such a fantastic response to that question. While you're talking, and this is not anywhere, but is it called the bullwhip, the bullcrack, something like that? Is that
the bullwhip effect?
Sorry, one more time.
The bullwhip effect.
Can you explain what that is for the people that aren't, and maybe even me, but for the people that aren't super savvy about what it means?
Yeah, so the bullwhip effect is one of the most well-known concepts within supply chain. And the pandemic has just created the biggest bullwhip probably in my lifetime, and I hope for a very long time even beyond that. But what it means is that once you're unable to deliver to your customers, the typical reaction is that you order a little bit more than you would normally order. And your supplier getting an order, a bigger order than they usually get, they also order a little bit more. And often supply chains have maybe 5 or even 10 layers of suppliers through that value chain. And what happens is that every layer starts to order a little bit more. And eventually that builds up this huge inventory situation that we have also seen now in the pandemic, and gets followed by everybody all of a sudden having way too much inventory and stop ordering, and then the volumes fall. So you get this huge variation in terms of order sizes and volumes that are moving in the supply chain. And it's very often because you are struggling to pass out in the future. So that kind of increased demand signal at the front end of the supply chain creates a much bigger variation through the layers of the supply chain, and then it'll have to work its way back again after that.
And that's what you feel like we're in right now? That's part of it? Like we're in the, sort of the aftershocks of that? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. We're clearly in the first very low part of the biggest end of the bullwhip, and I suspect that in 6 to 9 months, we're going to see demand go up quite significantly again above historical averages, and then it's going to fall down below again, but less. So it's going to slowly come back to what would be a more normal variation over the coming couple of years, probably. It's going to take.
I love that. That's such a good, I didn't intend to ask about that, but I feel so proud that I knew to bring that up. I was like, I even knew the terminology. I remember hearing about that because people were talking about that. I try to keep my fingers on the pulse of everything. But at the end of the day, the one thing that I think people can rely on is people got to eat. Kids got to be taught. Medical emergencies need to be tended to. People want to be kept safe from predatory people. So there's certain constants that are going to continue. If not, and although like in terms of supply chain, we got this kind of wave effect that we're going through, the bullwhip effect you're mentioning, within the countries and the territories themselves, like people want to eat every day. So as far as what it means to a smaller, medium-sized business owner, how do they handle that? What are the ramifications? I mean, because, so I'm going off script a little bit here, but that's fine. You talk about diversifying supply chains in the name of resilience. I lived in Vietnam for 2.5 years. I was actually stuck there for most of the pandemic. And as far as I could tell, it was booming as far as manufacturing because it was almost like the new China. Can you speak to that a little bit? Where are the big developments happening?
Yeah, so one of the things that are clearly happening in supply chains is that, as I said, demand doesn't change that much. Yeah, it may change within a 5 percentage point range, but that's not significant to cause a major change. But clearly, one of the things that the pandemic has taught us is that a single source supply chain is risky, because for various reasons, that one origin or that one source of your product may shut down. It could be a pandemic, it could be a trade war where all of a sudden you get 20% extra import duty, or it could be something more simple like an earthquake or other things that really disrupt the supply chain. And so for quite a while, diversify sourcing and have more than one source of products. I think if you're very small, that's challenging. So if you're a startup, it might be very challenging to have several sources of your products. But as soon as you get enough scale, my clear recommendation is that you should get two sources of your products. And that's also then raw materials and components and so on, because it creates a much stronger resilience against these disruptions in the supply chain. Yeah. And clearly that's causing right now, China has since for the last 20, probably 30 years been the factory of the world. And therefore the natural development now is that a lot of companies are diversifying. I wouldn't say out of China, but it's China plus one, because they're not leaving China. They're just not building additional capacity in China right now. And that additional capacity for production instead is being is being built in other countries, and some of the biggest ones developing right now, I mean, Vietnam is clearly taking a lot of that. Also, places like Indonesia, India, Cambodia are some of the countries in Asia. And then if you look at North America, for instance, it's Mexico. So there's a lot of production capacity being built in Mexico these years. And if you look at Europe, then it's typically Turkey and other places also closer to Europe that are being developed as alternative sources.
Is there a theme for the different locations?
Yeah.
What's coming out of Vietnam versus Indonesia versus?
Yeah, so Vietnam has really taken on a lot of the technology. So North Vietnam now has a huge technology cluster where they're doing laptops and mobile phones and so on. I would say Indonesia, probably the biggest categories coming out of Indonesia would be shoes and garments still. And that is a traditional industry in Indonesia that I think is still the predominant one there. India is a sourcing country that is growing tremendously and actually across many categories. So the Indian government has had a strong policy of made in India. So if you, as a multinational company, if you want to be active in India, you have to have local production. And that means that local production has a very broad base across multiple industries.
I love that. Yeah, I know that India is huge for big pharma in the future. It's a massive market. And India is pumping out a ton. It's a huge supplier of medicine, essential medicines that we get all the time.
Yeah, that's correct.
What about Cambodia?
Yeah, Cambodia is also a lot of footwear and garments is probably the biggest commodity. Cambodia is also growing strongly within the chemical industries and also within kind of ceramics. So if you're talking about toilets or bathroom furniture, those kind of things, also very strong growth in Cambodia these years.
And so what about Mexico? I think this is immensely valuable. What about Mexico and Turkey?
Yeah, I think Turkey has seen a strong growth in white goods, as an example, fridges and more simple electronics like TVs and stuff like that, but also a lot of garments, for instance, or clothing, et cetera, et cetera. Mexico, again, is more broad-based. And Mexico actually is, rather than producing everything from scratch, Mexico has really become an assembly line. So it's everything from, again, electronics to cars to almost, again, lots and lots of products being now assembled in Mexico. And it has to do partly also with some of the tariffs. So obviously there is...
Yeah, I know about that from Canada. We sell the U.S. lumber and then buy it back as furniture.
Yes. So the trade agreements are obviously driving that if something is made in Mexico, the import duty is significantly lower. And rather than then producing everything from scratch in Mexico, what typically happens in some of these scenarios is that these countries become assembly lines. So you ship semi-finished product into that country, in this case, Mexico, and then you do the final assembly in Mexico, and then it's a made-in-Mexico product, and there'll be different import duties applying, as an example.
Yeah, that's really powerful. I missed part. You said something, I just got more broad-based in Mexico and then assembly line, but you said it was more, or sorry, Turkey. You said TV, simple electronics, clothes. Did you say writing goods?
White goods. So fridges, freeze machines, dryers.
Like appliances.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Got it. Yeah, okay. Now,
Daryl, maybe I can just build on this because I think really as an SME, one of the things that is very valuable to understand is some of these free trade agreements, because this is a way to become super attractive for customers. Is if you're set up in the right country, if you understand the free trade agreements correctly, you can really become a very competitive. So even if you're much smaller and even if your production cost is perhaps higher than some of your bigger competitors, if you have an advantage in terms of the trade agreements, then you can become much more competitive and punch above your weight.
I love that. I actually put that down. So this is very personal, but my wife and I are getting, this is totally personal. So my wife and I are getting very heavily involved in dragon fruit farming. And so for people like that, where there's a local market, but there's also exporting market, it sounds like you touched on that. You need to understand the trade agreements, it sounds like, for that, right? Mostly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Understand the countries that have more favorable import duties or trade agreements with the country where you're producing, and then target primarily those markets. Your product will typically be 15-20% cheaper.
Right.
In that country compared to in another country that doesn't have a free trade agreement. Of course, tariffs are at very different levels. It depends on what kind of product you're producing. Typically, tariffs on, this is very different for different product groups, whether it's food or medicine or import
right.
Tariffs on medicine, as an example, are typically very low because every country wants to have the best medicines for their countries.
Right.
And unless they have a medical industry themselves that they want to protect, then typically those duties are pretty low. But of course, in other categories, import duties can be pretty high. Clothing, shoes, those kind of things, typically a much higher import duty because they want to produce or they want to protect local industries. And also that's typically the same actually around food. Farmers are typically being have a relatively high level of protection by their governments, and that the way that is done is really by having import duties and taxes on foodstuff coming in from other countries. And this has to do with countries wanting to. This is seen as strategic to be able to feed your own people, as an example. So you want to make sure that you protect an industry that can feed your own people. And typically when you have these more called a strategic industry, then you'll see that those strategic industries are being protected more so than other industries.
Right. I love this. This is really powerful because we've seen a lot happen. If you want to talk about farming in general, what's happened in the Netherlands, Canada and the US are both forcing farmers to reduce nitrogen or fertilizer usage and that. And so it's interesting to see how things are progressing. So this is because I was about to ask, what would you recommend? Because one of the ways it's not only just supply chain resilience, but I think for a lot of companies, finding ways to do business outside your home country is also a form of resilience, especially if the future is potentially shaky, right? Can you speak to that a little bit? You talked a bit about understanding the trade agreements. What about in terms of getting your goods delivered intact on?
Yeah. So I think in terms of driving resilience, obviously you don't want to be dependent on one supplier or one country, and you don't want to be dependent on one country. You want to be more spread, as spread as you can be. Of course, it depends on the size of your company.
Right.
You can't spread it too thin either. That doesn't work. That becomes ineffective. But actually, doing business overseas is relatively easy, and it's much easier than most people think. I can definitely recommend you to go online and search up. You can learn a lot online about how to do this. And there are different ways of doing it. You can make a contract directly with a customer in another country where actually you are responsible as a supplier for delivering the product to them. Within logistics and supply chain, there are certain trading terms that are used, and they're actually regulated by the UN, and they're where the terms here is called DDP or delivered duty paid. And that means that the supplier is responsible for delivering the product wherever in the world that may be and for paying the duties on that product as well. And that means that for the customer, they actually look at you as a domestic supplier, and there's no difficulty for them or there's no hassle for them. And then you need, as the supplier or as the exporter, you need to find a logistics provider who can help you pay the duties and take care of all those things. But those suppliers are out there in the market. So there are many ways of doing trade, and it's actually not that difficult to do international trade. Of course, what some people do, and that's an alternative solution, is to find a distributor, right? So there are many companies who make a living of signing up with brands or with products or with suppliers, and they become the distributor for their market, and then they take care of everything, and that's another way. But of course, they will need to make a living, so they will take part of the margin. It'll also make life much easier if you're an exporter. So it depends a little bit. You can probably reach more markets if you work with distributors, and thereby you can spread your risk more. But it also depends on how big you are and how many markets you can really serve and how much margin you can afford to give away for a distributor to sit in between.
This is great advice. Now, what are some of the specific skills and behaviors that you believe are important for your staff to improve or develop?
Yeah, I think it probably ties back to some of the mega trends that are happening in the world, and especially in the world of supply chain and logistics right now. And some of those mega trends is around digitalization and technology, obviously, coming into the business much more than it's been in the past. So having an understanding of technology, and not necessarily how to build it, although that's also a great skill to have, but it's much more about how to utilize technology and keeping up with what's going on with AI and digital twins and all kinds of other things that are happening. That's an important one. I think supply chain is a network. It's very important to be able to collaborate. And of course, collaboration is many things. It's both building up relationships over really making them partnerships, if you will. but it's also something simple as languages, being able to communicate with suppliers and customers in other countries. And although I love Google Translate, I still don't think it's still not good enough that you can rely on it. There'll be too many misunderstandings or too many things, especially when you get into jargon around a product or about supply chain.
Yeah, that's such great advice. We've danced around some of this to really hit the nail on the head. Can you specifically try to itemize some of the greatest mistakes that you see either your clients or other entrepreneurs making?
So I think the biggest mistake that I see, and probably the mistake that I see more, or the mistake that I see more often, most often, is that customers are not, they're not aware of or not prioritizing to really utilize supply chain and logistics as a strategic differentiator. Too often, logistics and supply chain is being treated as a cost, and it's not well aligned with the strategy of the company. So one of the things I always advise is you supply chain and logistics has to follow the overall strategy of the company and support that overall strategy. And because the space is so dynamic and also because companies are growing and company strategies are changing, you have to constantly make adjustments and even whole evolutions of your supply chain. And I don't see that happening. I see that too many are just using a one-size-fits-all, leaving supply chain alone over in the corner. And to me, this is a pity, because there's a big opportunity to actually leverage supply chains to improve customer experience, to improve financials, to improve sustainability. There's so many things that supply chain can do for you if you utilize it in an active way.
I think that's really important. I think I mentioned before, I spent about $50,000 US hiring 10 research assistants to help me go through all the academic literature on business success from all over the world. And having a locus of control is critically important. If you look at FedEx, their whole unique selling proposition was an excellent supply chain, excellent logistics. And so by having, it's a catch-22. I know some people, they talk about, I only do one thing and everything else I third party out. And that can work really well, but also you give up control. And sometimes in the case of, we talked about China, some people may feel that your manufacturer, your third-party partners may not respect your NDAs, right? So there's catch-22, whereas if you bring it in-house, you really, capacity utilization was one of the most important factors in terms of money management. And capacity utilization is everything from making sure your staff show up on time, they show up ready to work, that they're well-fueled and engaged all day. If you're in a dark room, hunched over like desks and cubicles, they're not going to be as productive, and even just morale is not going to be as good as it could as if you had a brightly colored, nicely lit, brightly colored, fresh air, ergonomic chairs. It's small details in this thing. And I think that people don't also fail to realize just how competitive the world is, and that it's a game in some ways of inches. Once you're in a market, it's the little details. You have to obsess about marginal gains on the small things against your competitors. And so I just-in-time delivery, just-in-time manufacturing was a huge advantage in the past. Maybe can you speak to that? Has that changed? Talking about this bullwhip, the bullwhip effect, has that impacted just-in-time in a big way?
Yeah, it has definitely impacted just-in-time. And I think for a period of time, it turned to a just-in-case type of supply chain. So actually, everybody built up buffers everywhere just in case. And honestly, that's equally wrong. And it's back to my point that you cannot think of supply chain as one size fits all.
Mm-hmm.
What is my company strategy? And then you have to set everything up from that. And there will be some companies for whom supply chain is not important for the success of the company. And if that is the case, I definitely fully recommend that you find a partner and you outsource the whole thing. Let that partner take care of it, make it simple, don't spend time on it, and so on. But if you come to the conclusion that supply chain is actually important for you in the game of inches, for you to win, then you have to lean in and then you have to start really looking at that supply chain.
Yeah.
I typically, through my many years of working with customers on optimizing their supply chains, I found that there are typically 10 supply chain parameters that you want to look at. You shouldn't drive all 10 because that's almost never relevant for your business. But I give you some examples. So you got to consider what should be the speed of my supply chain. Do I need to move stuff really fast? So if you are an innovative company that is winning against your competition by bringing the newest innovation on the market first, then you need to have a very fast supply chain. Now, and another one is sustainability, right? What is your need for sustainability in your supply chain? And you need to set up your supply chain for that. Of course, there's always cost is always a factor for almost every company. Of course, you may be, if you're really that innovative company that just brings the newest thing to the market and it's all about new features and the latest innovation, you may actually choose to have a more costly mm-hmm. supply chain because that's still what makes you win. But if you are in trading in black socks and white t-shirts, you got to right. be very lean on your supply chain and make sure that you have a super low cost supply chain.
Right.
And as I said, there is probably 10 of these. Happy to list them out if you'd like. But So let me share what they are in my experience. It's speed, as I said. It's sustainability. It's cost. It's reliability of the supply chain. And closely linked, but not the same, is the agility of the supply chain. How fast can you pivot? How fast can you change? How late can you wait by making decisions? It's the customer experience or the stakeholder experience. It's not always a customer, but what is the experience you get from the supply chain? Is it easy or is it a lot of work, difficult to work with? There's compliance. So we talked before about trade agreements and there are many other things that you need to be compliant with. So that's an important factor to consider, at least in some product groups. There's safety and there's security. Those would for me be the 10 parameters of the supply chain that you need to look at. And then you need to, my recommendation is almost list out those 10 supply chain parameters. Score them from 1 to 10 in terms of how important are they for the success of your company. And then try next after to score what is actually the performance you have in your current supply chain. And then pick out 2 to 3 of the parameters and decide that for the next 6 months, I'm going to work on these 2 to 3 parameters to really close the gap between where I would like to be or where my business would be most successful and where I am today. Once you're done with that, do the same thing again. Probably the world has changed and you pick another 2 to 3 parameters and you work on them for the next 6 months. It's a continuous improvement loop and you'll never finish.
Yeah, I love that. And especially because of the fact that there's a great book called The Theory of, Goal. And it's about the theory of constraints.
Yes.
And so it doesn't matter if your capacity, if you have a 4-step process and your capacity, just easy example. You have a 4-step process and the capacity is a level of 10 for all of them, but the third one is a level of 2. Increasing the capacity of the other 3 at all will not change anything because your choke point is at a level of 3. The biggest thing impact you can have is taking a look at that third step that's at a level of 3 and the others at 10. And how can you expand that to now reach the level of 10? And a lot of people in their business, they don't know what they don't know. And so they just keep improving capacity in things that are not the choke point. And that's, I love this again. Can we quickly go through those 10 again? It was speed, sustainability, cost, reliability, agility, customer experience or stakeholder experience, compliance, safety, security.
Resilience is the one we missed. And maybe I even missed it when I was listing them out.
That's okay. And resilience. There we go. And that's a fantastic exercise for everyone here to do. Just write those down. I think this is really powerful. There's some great tips that we had in this. Now, I have a question. Not everyone gets to be COO of a $3 billion company. What are some of the habits that you feel have helped you most on your path to success? Daily, weekly, monthly, just habits.
Yeah, for me, one of my clear habits is structure. So I work very structured. Every Monday morning, I start off looking at my calendar for the next 2 to 3 weeks. I look at what's in my calendar. I delegate stuff. I put in stuff that is missing. I make sure that I'm spending my time over the next 2 to 3 weeks things that are important to deliver the outcome that is necessary.
Mm.
Another thing that has helped my success is clearly leadership. So I have worked across almost every function of the company, except for technology and legal, but I've been in operations, I've been in sales, I've been in customer service, I've been in human resources, I've been in finance, you name it, almost I've been there. And that means I'm not an expert in all of these fields. But what I've done is I have thrived and I have performed simply about building up a team, motivating that team, getting the team to work as a team, I think is another big part of my success.
That's great. I love that. So I know I want to be respectful of your time. I know we're approaching the end. I have a couple of questions. One is, what are some of the future trends? What do you see that you've already mentioned, like technology, like AI? What trends, what are you keeping your eye on over the next kind of 3, 5, 10 years that you think a small and medium-sized business owner needs to be paying close attention to?
Yeah, so technology is a big one and probably the biggest one. And then it depends on how broad or how narrow you define technology, because automation or robotics is either part of that or it's the other part that is super important. And I think if you're in any kind of product range that requires some kind of manufacturing, these are very important trends mm-hmm. to watch. Another thing to watch is the geopolitical situation. It could have huge impact on what will happen in global supply chains and in global trade patterns over the coming years. I'm unapologetic supporter of global trade. I think global trade has delivered so much value to billions of people in the world, and I think it's great. But obviously there is a risk to that narrative, unfortunately, right now. So that's definitely something to watch. And then I think a third mega trend to watch is sustainability. There's no doubt that sustainability is growing in importance across every aspect of it, and maybe it's broader than sustainability. Maybe you should say ESG, environmental, social, and government or governance issues, definitely also very important.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with a lot of those. I think there's, and you don't have to agree if you don't, or even say anything, but it does seem like there's a couple of philosophies being given a lot of airtime in the world stage that seem to almost be anti-human civilization, like the zero growth philosophy for economics. Like, I'm not sure how people die when there's no growth. There's negative growth when there's war and famine. That's how you achieve. So how the zero growth economy nonsense seems.
Yeah, I don't believe in zero growth either, Daryl, but I do believe that we need to find a much more sustainable way of delivering that growth, because it's clear that right now we are environment we're living in, and that cannot continue. As an example, at Maersk, and I'm super proud of this, I have to say, we were the first in the industry to make a commitment to get to net zero in terms of carbon emissions. And initially we said 2050, and we have actually now upped the bar, and we're now saying 2040. And that's extremely challenging. The shipping and logistics industry is one of these very hard to abate industries. But we're making great progress. We've invested a lot of money in research and development. And actually, in September, so just a few months ago, we were able to launch the first carbon neutral container ship in the world, sailing on green methanol. So proving that it can be done. And I have to be honest and say, 5 years ago, I didn't even see a path myself towards this. And today we have a path, and now it's about scaling that path. Now, green methanol may not scale to the global growth, but for now, it's the best technology that is there. It works here and now, and we are deploying that. And luckily, Maersk we're now not the only one. So lots of other companies are following us. We're also collaborating and partnering with them, because quite frankly, this should not be a competitive field. This should be something where we all collaborate to decarbonize supply chains.
Yeah, I agree on that. I think it's really hard to refute that there's, I don't want to say overdevelopment, because there's a lot. It's a weird catch 22. I don't want to go over too long. I want to be respectful of your time, but I think this is an important, since it's such a pertinent topic. It's clear that things like 12 years ago, I went to Thailand for a holiday and I rode a speedboat for 2 hours away from civilization to get this remote island. I'm snorkeling with Nemo and his friends, having the time of my life. And all of a sudden we find ourselves in a garbage patch. You know what I mean? Floating in the water. There's things like that are just undeniable. The landfills, this is undeniable. But we also have to be careful because there are people, not everyone in the world has good intentions. And there's lots of people that are willing to use good intentions. Like the best victim for a psychopath is a genuinely good person, because a genuinely good person will not think another person could be a complete psychopath. And the psychopath will weaponize their kindness and generosity. So we have to move forward, like you say, into a sustainable future, watching out for Trojan horses that are put into that agenda. And I think that's a really important thing to just put on people's radar there. And I also think you talked about geopolitics. This is my own personal opinion. But I think if people talked more about outcomes versus tribalism, that could solve so much of this. Some things maybe are difficult, like Israel-Palestine borders, things. But if people can still focus on the outcome, there's been so much divisiveness in the world these days. And I think a lot of it is like us versus them, tribalism mentality versus what's the goal for us as a species? Where do we want to be? Where do we want to head? And if we can all agree on that stuff, I think some of those lines in the sand would dissolve, so to speak.
But I believe I'm a very strong believer in global trade and the value that is bringing to people and how it's improving the lives of billions of people, right? A couple of examples. I think there's probably not a single human being in the world who is able to independently produce the work tool that is today the most important work tool for human being, namely the mobile phone. There is simply not a single individual in the entire world who can build a mobile phone. And yet the amount of productivity that has given to us as a species is unbelievable, right?
Yes.
And just a few hundred, huge part of the population were tied up in basically gathering or producing food for themselves or for others. And of course, we still consume the same amount of food we did back then, and it's probably even better food. It is better quality food and more varied food than it was back then.
More secure.
And today, we can pay for that food with a relatively small amount of the income that we're generating. And meanwhile, we can specialize, right? So people can specialize in becoming doctors. And then those of us who have not chosen to become doctors, we can go to the doctor and get help and get advice. And so there's a huge improvement in the quality of life. Of course, we need to do that in a sustainable way. And we also need to do it in a way whereby the gains are shared in a reasonable way, fair way. But we certainly shouldn't stop trading with each other. That, at least to me, would be devastating and would be impacting the quality of life for billions of people.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think there was a political debate about indoor toilets. There are indoor plumbing. There is no, the flies are our friends. There were no protests. The flies are our friends. Everyone agreed that having a nice toilet is a nice thing. And as you mentioned, nowadays, a lot of that's coming from Cambodia, it sounds like, right? So together, yeah. They say, if you want to walk fast, walk alone. If you want to go far, walk together. And I think it's a great, great concept. Talk about world trade. Martin, this has been a great interview. I've got pages of notes. Is there anything I haven't asked you that I should have asked you?
Let me just look through my notes, Daryl. I did prepare a few things, and I think actually we've talked about all of them. Yeah, we've been through it all, Daryl, at least at a high level. So I think we're good.
Good. Now, if people want to reach out, if they have questions or they want to reach out and get in touch, what's one of the best ways for them to communicate with you?
Probably the best place to find me is on LinkedIn. Just look me up, Martin Holmer, working at Maersk. I'm sure you'll find me. And I'll be happy to engage with you there.
Sounds like a plan. So go on LinkedIn and look him up. Martin, Martin Holm, Holme. And you know it's the right guy if he's based in Singapore and working at Maersk. Martin, thank you so much for joining us, my friend. It has been an honor and a pleasure knowing that you've got your own teams, your own community, your own family to take care of. Beautiful photo in the background, by the way. Thank you for coming and sharing with me in mind so we can all walk together into the future and do a little bit better.
Thanks again for having me, and thanks for shining a spotlight on supply chains.